very unique parsha, because it is one of the only few parshios in the entire Torah where there is literally no break whatsoever in the entirety of Balak's prophecies. And just to elaborate on the point that we made yesterday from the Chafetz Chaim points out that the significance of breaks in the paragraphs, whether they're the Parsha Pstuma, which is the break of 9 letters, or it's a Parsha Psucha, in which a paragraph ends in the middle of a line, and the next paragraph begins on the next line, the significance of breaks indicates the idea of disengagement, meaning to say that a Moshe Rabbeinu could be involved in Torah, in learning Torah, in talking to God, and then somebody comes with a problem, so Moshe Rabbeinu was able to disengage himself from God's Torah, deal with the problem that needs to be dealt with, and then immediately get himself back into it. That's a very, very significant madrega, because that enables a person, as it were, not to be controlled by their emotions, by their passions, by their feelings, but rather, when it's time to do this, you do that. When it's time to do that, you do that. When it's time to do that, you do that. In other words, every single thing one responds to on the merits of it, and not simply because they're into it and they can't take themselves out. By contrast, the Chafetz Chaim says, Bilam, although supremely gifted in many ways, and Bilam, as we said yesterday, was considered to be a prophet of the rank of Moshe Rabbeinu himself, Bilam was a creature of whatever emotional state happened to seize him at the time. When Bilam was seized of prophecy, there is no break. Bilam could not, as it were, do anything else. And consequently, the lack of breaks, in other words, the continuity of the structure of the parsha, indicates a person who is a victim of whatever emotional state happens to take charge of him at any given moment in time. And although prophecy might be a good thing all in all, but ultimately a person needs to be able to control how he responds based on the moral needs of the moment, and not simply because, you know, now you're in a mood to be ecstatic, so you sing, and tomorrow you'll be in a mood to complain, so you complain. Rather, one uses their mind to control and regulate how they respond in any given situation. Yeah.
I can understand the fact that he was always involved with whatever he was doing and unable to switch around.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of the actual prophecy part of it, doesn't it say that typically a prophet was so overwhelmed by his prophecy, even the Jewish prophets, that they were almost on the ground and they couldn't even function at all? So
that is true to some degree. On the other hand, we do contrast that with Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, which represents the supreme level of what a human being can achieve, was the one who was able to turn it off and turn it on, turn it off and turn it on, and move back and forth between daily life and prophecy, because ultimately you do what needs to be done in order to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In other words, the analogy would be, imagine a person who is very deeply engrossed in learning the laws of charity. One is learning the Rambam Hilchos Tzedakah, and one is indeed very engrossed in some deep Talmudic interpretations about the mitzvah of giving charity. And then there's a knock on the door that interrupts his reverie, interrupts his concentration, breaks his continuity of thoughts. And it's a poor person who needs money. Now, the person's instinctive reaction might be, why are you bothering me? I am deeply in concentration. But you see how wrong that response would be, because the whole purpose of learning the laws of charity are to be able to help people when they're in need. And yet, if you're a victim of your emotional state, if your emotional state is one of concentration and depth, you will not be able to have the flexibility to respond to what needs to be responded to, right? So Chafetz Chaim points out that is a significant distinction between Bilam and Moshe Rabbeinu. And in fact, I think I may have shared this thought before, the Sfas Emes says that this is implicit in the notion of what Tosfos. Tosfos says in Maseches Brachos that what was Bilam's great success? Bilam's great success was that there was 1 second in the day, actually less than a second, a certain fraction of the hour every day in which God has anger on the world. So if somebody manages to curse exactly in that second, that curse is going to be effective because God has anger for that particular second. The greatness of Bilam, the Gemara says, was Bilam knew exactly when that second was. Bilam could choose the second, or he knew the second. So Tosfos in Maseches Brachos asks a very simple kasha. If, in order for the curse to be effective, you got to say it exactly in that moment, what could you say in that moment? In other words, what curse is so short that you could get it in for that moment? By the time you say a whole curse, you're past the moment. So one might have answered, okay, as long as you begin it in the right moment, you could finish it afterwards. But Tosfos gives a different answer. Tosfos says, Bilam could have said a one-word curse, a two-syllable curse of one word, and that one word is kalein, kaf lamid mem, destroy them, kalein. That could have been under the wire. That is enough of a curse that's short enough that you could say it within that time frame. But it says in the Sifrei Chassidus that kalein is actually an abbreviation for kolayos. The chaf is kolayos, the kidneys. The lamed is lev, which is hearts, and the mem is moach, which is mind. The kidneys, in rabbinic literature, is the seat of emotion and passion. Particularly sexual urges, are said to come from the kidneys. That's how it's described. The lev is also the seat of emotion. The moach is the mind. What Bilam, in effect, is saying is, the greatest curse that you could put on a person, a curse that will result in their utter destruction, is when their mind is subordinate. In other words, the mind is last. Kidneys and hearts rule and direct the mind. That is kalein, that is destruction. Because the mind is simply employed as a tool to justify whatever the emotions and the passions want, right? We can tell you all the time that we decide we want something, and then we develop a philosophy that will justify whatever it is that we want. That which is expedient, and that which is convenient, and that which is pleasurable, we will simply define as that which is good and moral. It's like the story about the person who was a perfect aim. He used to have target practice against the wall or a wall of his barn. Or either arrow practice, whatever it would be. And a passerby noticed that every single arrow had hit the bullseye exactly. And the passerby asks the person, how is it possible that you have a 100% accuracy rate, that every single arrow is right in the middle of the bullseye? And the person's answer was, well, it's quite simple. First I shoot the arrow, and then I draw the target. So consequently, I shoot the arrow, and then I draw the bullseye around the arrow, so I'm there all the time. The truth of the matter is that in the philosophies of life, we often fall prone to the same idea, in which we go where we want to go, and then we devise the philosophy that justifies it. And that is an instance of kalein. The kalaios and the lev, the kidneys and the heart, rule the mind. The mind is simply used to direct you in wherever your passions want to go, and that's a form of slavery. Now, the opposite of kalein, if you reverse the letters, is melech. Right? Melech is mem lamid chaf. That's moach. That's the mind. The lamid is the heart, and the kalayos are the passions. That's when the passions and the emotions are subordinated to the directives of the mind. The mind, I don't just mean the intellectual faculty, but in the mind, in the moach, we also include the moral sense, the sense of what is moral and ethical, meaning to say that my mind is not victimized, it is not held hostage by my emotions. And therefore the Sfas Emes says, when the Pasuk says, V'yafoch Hashem Elokecha es haklolo livrecha, God reversed the curse of Bilam into a blessing. So the Sfas Emes says very beautifully, the curse of Bilam would have been kalein, they should be destroyed, like Tosfos says. And that's kolayos leiv moach, that the kidneys and the emotions control the mind. God reversed it to melech, and that is why you find, if you look at all of the brachos of Bilam, you will always see that the concept of referring to Hashem and Bnei Yisrael as melech is a very, very prominent theme, because that is what God did. God reversed it, the opposite. Now, one might say this. How did Bilaam have the insight that utter destruction comes when the Kalayos and the Leis rule over the Moach? Tama, probably it is the case that Bilaam saw this from his own life, because Bilaam was a man of supreme intellect. Bilaam was a man of tremendous talent. But Bilaam knew in his own life the tragedy of being controlled by passions which are not subject to any type of discipline. Right? Bilaam is the prototype, Chazal say, of the Ayin Ra, the person who was consumed with jealousy over the good fortune of others. And Bilaam is the prototype of Nefesh Rechava. A Nefesh Rechava means a broad soul. That means one who had unquenchable desires for sensual and material pleasures. And finally, he was the prototype of Ruach Gevaya, of the Baal Gaiva, the arrogant person, the one who looks down at others and is filled with the need for ego gratification. These are the three evil midos that Pirkei Avos describes as kina taiva v'kava, jealousy, lust, and a need for honor. And yet on one level, most people that have these midos aren't even aware that they're so bad. But Bilaam had the intellect to know how destructive his own life was to himself. And consequently, when he curses Bnei Yisrael, the curse effectively is, may you be like me. Because, imagine the agony. In a way, we have to almost have compassion for Bilaam, because he had the brilliance of self-awareness of how destructive his way of life was. The addict who is aware of the tragedy of his addiction is in a much more acute pain than the addict that lacks that self-awareness. Actually, just to give you I remember years ago when I was, I think, probably in 10th grade. So, in yeshivas, people like to drink on Purim, right? Even here, people drink on Purim, right? There's a mitzvah on Purim. Once you drink on Purim until you don't know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai, whatever the explanation of that is. So, I usually don't get drunk anymore, actually, after this experience. One year, some of my friends thought it would be nice to get me drunk. There's people like to get me drunk. And I still remember the very strange thing, and I really was sick as a dog afterwards, but that's beside the point. But one thing I do remember is that on one hand, I had no inhibitions. I was, saying things that I would normally keep to myself. But on the other hand, I also had an awareness that I was behaving out of character. It was the funniest sensation. I'm not sure. Yeah, I can't really. I don't know if other people who are drunk have that sensation. But it was like there were two brains. In which one brain was saying, you shut up, you behave, you're embarrassing yourself. And the other brain said, well, I really don't care, So there was really a sense of self-awareness combined with an inability to control the behavior. Bilaam was blessed, cursed, with a great deep degree of self-awareness, but he did not have the discipline or the wherewithal to control his passions. And therefore, in his own life, he saw his destruction. And thus he curses Bnei Yisrael. May you also have that curse.
So how does somebody know whether or not their emotions controlling their mind and their mind is justifying it? Or if it's the other way around, their mind is real and that the emotion is coming.
Right. Well, the truth of the matter is, sometimes we do know, because sometimes we do have the double brain phenomenon, in which we know we might be fooling ourselves. We may take a certain course of action, and we may even justify it. But very often, our own words ring hollow. Our own words, we may decide to do the cruel thing to somebody, the inconsiderate thing, and we may justify it by saying, well, it's a matter of principle or whatever it is, but deep inside, we often do know. So in many, many cases, we really just have to respond to the voice within us. That's one thing. But you are correct. Other times, we genuinely can be fooled. This is what is called in the books of ethics, negias. We may have personal agendas that can blind us from really understanding the situation. And that's why in many life decisions, it is important to have a rabbi or a spiritual advisor or even a good friend that you talk to about these things, simply because it is so easy to be blinded by personal interests which prevent you from seeing the objective truth. Now, there's also a tradition from Rav Chaim Volozhin. You heard of Rav Chaim Volozhin? Rav Chaim Volozhin was the great disciple of the Vilna Gaon. And Rav Chaim Volozhin said that if a person is undecided as to a certain course of action and doesn't know what's right, he should sit and learn Torah for 2 hours. And that kind of purifies the mind. And whatever you feel after you've learned Torah for a straight 2 hours, you can regard as the undiminished message of God, as this is how you should behave. So that's also an etzah. But the truth of the matter is, this is really why we learn Torah. Because learning Torah, you see, isn't only... This is the mystical power of Torah. Learning Torah isn't only for the practical guidance it gives us. For example, I can learn the laws of Shabbos, I know about Shabbos. But there's a metaphysical idea that by connecting yourself to the mind of God, overall you become a more objective judge of the reality. So even if you're studying Torah, that has nothing to do with the dilemma you're facing. Right? You're learning about a beautiful woman who's in a courtyard, right? And your issue is, you know, what college do you go to, or something like that. Right? There is no direct connection. But metaphysically there is a connection, because you're connecting yourself to God. God, of course, is the ultimate objective evaluator of reality. And we become, to a much, much diminished degree, of course, but we also become more objective in our judgments. But you're 100% correct. The idea of negias, of personal biases. Sometimes we're aware of them, and sometimes we just have no clue whatsoever. And we need limud haTorah and consultation with spiritual leaders to help us through these things. Yeah.
So what it does is it clears the mind of any pre-organized...
Well, I wouldn't say it eliminates it, but it kind of minimizes it. It curtails it. It shrinks it. It allows you to have a more objective, clear view of what the reality of the situation is. And that is what is called a melech. A melech is not a person who doesn't have feelings. It's not a person who doesn't have emotions. There are feelings, there are emotions. If one were to serve God without feelings and without emotions, it would be sterile, it would be empty, it would be superficial. And indeed, in one of the very powerful statements Rav Volba makes, if you've heard of Rav Shlomo Volba, Shlomo Volba here in Yerushalayim is really one of the last, really, Balei Musar, people who are involved intensively in ethical character building. And Rav Volba writes that one of the emotional dangers of a yeshiva setting, he actually says this, is that because we glorify the life of the mind to such a high degree, there is sometimes an atrophy of the emotions. A person stops feeling, because that's almost looked down upon. And Rav Volba actually writes that one of the gifts that one gets in marriage is the ability, as it were, to create an emotional relationship. But be it as it may, we do say emotions have a very important place. But the emotion must be subordinate to what the moral and intellectual sense direct us to. That emotionalism is not simply everything goes, and whatever I feel this moment is what is good. One needs the mind and the seichel to focus and direct and channel those emotions. And, you know, at its highest level, this is a very, very high madrega, meaning to say, when it's Tisha B'Av, in other words, there's a way of training ourselves, and I'm certainly not in this madrega, but there's a way of training ourselves where when the halakha says to be sad, you are genuinely sad. And when the halakha says to be happy, you are genuinely happy. In other words, the emotions that we often think are totally beyond our control become a function of what the halakha requires at any particular moment. Taken to a certain extreme, it is said about Yisrael Salanter that during Purim, he was absolutely stone drunk. Of course, as a gadol was drunk, I mean, he was saying Torah, just totally drunk, totally shikr, totally loose. And he looked up at the sky, Purim night, or the night after Purim, and as soon as the three stars were out, he immediately became what he had always been the rest of the year. This concept that on Purim, out of control, when Purim is over, back into control. That kind of immediate response to the halacha. I mean, I can tell you, an average person who's drunk, you're not going to get undrunk as soon as the stars are out. But exactly, that was the control that the person had. That's correct. That the out of control was in his control. And I mentioned that this is also true about emotions like anger. There is a concept that anger is sometimes appropriate externally, meaning sometimes discipline, sometimes one needs to protest evil. But that was an anger which is totally within the control of the person. A certain Rebbe said, anger is like a little animal I keep in a box. When I need to use it, I take it out. And when I'm finished with it, I put it back in the box. It never takes me over. And that's what a melech is. The mind rules over the turbulent emotions that control a person. A very, very high level. But that is malchus. That is what kingship is. Bilam represented the extremity of the opposite. So Bilam's talents were immense, including his self-awareness. But he was like a train, a runaway train, in which nothing could hold back. And of course, we'd have to say that many of us often find ourselves in that situation, the concept of losing control. You know, it's interesting. There used to be, now it's actually out of vogue, but there used to be a psychological school that taught the benefits of letting it all out. There was a certain school of psychology that said that when you're angry, instead of holding it in, which will destroy you inside, you should let it out. Well, scream therapy, okay, too, is not so bad, because that's like hitting the punching bag, that's just screaming. But the letting it out was directing to the person you're angry at and telling him what a jerk he is and how much you despise him and everything else. But I read Rabbi Pliskin brings that this guy's own children didn't invite him to their wedding after all. So it didn't work as a very successful way of raising children. Now, on the other hand, the Torah does acknowledge the idea of letting out steam in constructive ways. You know, the Torah says a very interesting thing. The Torah says, Lo sisne es ochicha bilvavecha. Do not hate your brother in your hearts. The Ramban says, Beferish, that if someone has hurt you, and you feel resentment in your heart, don't let it fester. Don't keep it to yourself. Because if you keep it to yourself, it'll just build and build and build and build, and your hate will build, and your anger will build, and it may come out against innocent people, and there may be some minor thing in which you explode. The Ramban says, talk to the person about it. Say what bothers you. That's the mitzvah of giving a person mussar. However, don't do it by yelling at him and expressing anger. But do it in a calm, measured way, and try to work it out. And if there's a bit of misunderstanding, perhaps communication can clarify it. And if the guy's in the wrong, then maybe the guy will apologize, whatever it is. So, on one end, Judaism recognizes there is an important idea of not keeping things to yourself. But it also says, don't set off an atom bomb to get rid of a mosquito. Meaning to say, your response has to be proportional to what the situation is. Yeah.
What about the balance between saying what you feel, but also holding back saying what you feel because you know that it may have adverse effects on the person in your speaking?
Well, you have to make a balanced cheshbon, meaning to say, sometimes it's important to express your feelings, and that is considered to be important, but sometimes it may not necessarily be to the person that hurt you, because the hurt to that person may be very, very great. And in fact, there are many laws within the laws of Lashon Hara that normally say you don't say negative things, that you are allowed to communicate your negative feelings about a certain person to a friend or a psychologist or a rabbi or even a spouse in order to help you deal with the anger and the resentment in a positive way. So, one should not feel. The Torah is not a straitjacket. There are laws against Lashon Hara. Of course, you don't just say bad things about people. But Halacha recognizes the importance of communication in diffusing angers and resentments. And you are correct. Sometimes that would not necessarily be to the person themselves. One has to judge the situation. Sometimes, however, the best policy might be to be honest and forthcoming in communicating. Again, there are many techniques about dealing with anger. Again, it's not directly okay here. I mean, anger is just an example. I pick anger because anger might be the most common example of an emotion that gets us when we're out of control. Because anger is something, is the hardest thing to consciously control. But they say the altar of Kelim used to have a special anger coat this was his technique, that whenever he felt upset, before he would express his anger, he had to put on his special coat in the closet. So, you know, as you know, by the time you put on the coat, the feeling often passes. So by making those types of little tricks, these are ways that can control you. I'm sorry, so, Jenny, hand up.
Yeah,
just
a small issue from what with anger. If you're not, anger doesn't come into it, but you know someone's doing things which are not halakhically correct.
Yeah.
And you know that people know what the halakhah should be. Should you sort of be a bit of a, inverted commas, crusader and sort of speak to them about it? Or should you make a question and say, if I speak to them, A, will they take a notice, and B, will they have permanently have a lead against me?
Well, here, of course, you know, we're dealing with not just being a crusader, we're dealing with one of the 613 mitzvahs, right? One of the 613 mitzvahs. Hocheach tochiach es hamisach. That means what? If I see a Jew doing something wrong, according to the Torah, I have a mitzvah to go over to that Jew and correct him. Of course, it has to be in a dignified, respectful, non-embarrassing way, and call it to his attention. It is brought down, by the way, that if you're not capable of giving tochacha in a way that doesn't humiliate a person, you shouldn't do the mitzvah at all. But if you're able to do it in a nice way. However, the countervailing idea is this. The Gemara does say in Maseches Beah that certain times we do not give tochacha, because if it's likely that the person is going to disobey anyway and not listen to us, better that he do the aveira unintentionally without us giving him the tochacha than for him to violate it intentionally. Now, if he's already doing it intentionally, then the question still becomes, is there any reasonable probability that that person will stop doing the aveira because of your say-so, or will that create more resentments and more defiance, etc.? And remember, the ultimate goal of tochacha is to help a fellow Jew in not doing aveiras. And therefore, essentially, it's a very hard answer to apply, but the principle is a very simple principle. The question in all cases is this. Is my intervention more likely to reduce an aveira, or is my intervention more likely to increase the aveira? That's really the question. And if your intervention is more likely to produce stubbornness and resentment, it is better not to talk. And that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, just like it is a mitzvah to say words that will be received, it is a mitzvah not to say words that will not be received. In fact, they tell the story about a Hasidic Rebbe that had a bunch of balabatim who were not very generous in tzedakah. The Rebbe was always giving a mussar shmooze about giving charity, etc., and nobody was giving anything. So finally, Erev Yom Kippur, he calls a lot of his Hasidim to him. And they sit down, and he sits down, and he doesn't say anything at all. And they finally ask the Rebbe, and the Rebbe then says, thank you very much, and then they leave. And they ask the Rebbe, why did you call us here if you weren't going to say anything? The Rebbe says, well, I was fulfilling the mitzvah of the Gemara. The Gemara says, just like there's a mitzvah to say words that are listened to, there's a mitzvah not to say words that are not listened to. Since I know that anything I say you don't listen to, I wanted to fulfill the mitzvah of not saying words that are not listened to. So thank you very much that before Yom Kippur, you gave me a chance to fulfill the mitzvah of not talking. Okay, but and I think actually that actually worked on them, and they gave tzedakah. But that's really the ultimate goal. I mean, for example, let's take in the United, well, I mean, even in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, in a sense, you know, you have more segregated neighborhoods, but you know, in America, a Shomer Shabbos could be living next to somebody who mows his lawn on Shabbos, a Jew, right? So what do you do? Every time I see my neighbor mowing his lawn, I'm supposed to say, you know, you're not allowed to mow your lawn on Shabbos. I mean, the person's going to think I'm crazy. So obviously, the form that tochacha takes in a case like that is not telling the person, hey, you're not supposed to mow your lawn on Shabbos, but it's inviting him to your house. It's wishing good Shabbos to him in a friendly way. In other words, you do things in which he begins to get an inkling of Shabbos as a special day. And then that might eventually, and particularly when you make your home available for hospitality, and that may eventually have some type of effect. But just to tell a person, don't mow your lawn on Shabbos, what is that going to do? That's not going to that's not going to have any positive effect at all. Yeah.
So about telling somebody not saying, what about it in respect to digital marriage? They're obviously aware of the prohibition and that
Right.
It's not something that they just have no idea about it.
Right.
They're, you know, just doing it unintentionally. It's an intentional act. So if you're your friend who's dating somebody or engaged,
Well, again, you have to understand that when it comes to intentionality, there are infinite levers of intentionality. Almost any Jew who's marrying a goy knows that Judaism does not like intermarriage. But a person may know that in his head, but doesn't realize, you know, how important it is, how significant it is, what the consequences are, how they're cutting off a chain, you know, that's been going on for thousands and thousands of years. So just to say they're intentional, that doesn't mean they know. However, keep in mind the following idea, that if somebody went through 22 or 24 years of life without being given a positive reason to be Jewish, it's very hard at 24 when somebody's engaged to a goy to give the person a convincing reason why Judaism is so important that they shouldn't marry a non-Jewish woman. You know, what's so important about it? You know, we didn't go to shul, we didn't keep kosher, we didn't keep Shabbos, we didn't do mitzvahs. It's just an ethnic thing. That's racism. And you know, they might be right. In other words, for somebody to say that, you know, when Torah didn't matter in their lives at all, but you can only marry a Jew, one might say, hey, that's not fair, that's not right. That's, you know, just like when I hear a Reformed congregation say they don't want a woman rabbi. I feel that's sexist. Meaning to say, if you live by halacha, so halacha has rules. But if you don't live by halacha, why shouldn't a woman be a rabbi? In other words, what? Shabbos you don't have to keep, and kashrus you don't have to keep, but you can't have a woman rabbi? That's unfair.
Rabbi. Huh? But a lesbian rabbi.
Well, okay, you could debate, you know. There might be limits. But what I'm saying is that's picking and choosing. So the truth of the matter is, real education against intermarriage usually has to start way before the person's already involved. But nevertheless, you know, if you can have some influence, obviously the earlier the intervention, let's say somebody just went out with one date with a non-Jew, you know, a person, you might be more effective. If someone's engaged to a woman that they love, you know, it's going to be mighty, mighty hard to make that change. But nevertheless, my answer to you in short is that merely because somebody knows in a general sense that something is regarded as wrong does not mean they really see the consequences of it. Therefore, it might be worthwhile to bring out some things. Okay. Yeah, this was just a little digression. We were really talking about anger, and then we got into tochacha from this. But I just want to say one thing. The translation of the word tochacha is very important. Most people translate tochacha as chastisement or criticism. Criticize. That is not an accurate translation. And this is not even reflected in the English. The true meaning of tochacha is demonstration. In other words, when it says give tochacha to your friend, it doesn't mean chastise him, criticize him, critique him, or rebuke him. Rebuke is often the term that's used. But it doesn't mean rebuke. It means demonstrate to him what is the right way. Now, in some cases, that might be rebuke. In other words, if somebody knows the halachas very clearly, sometimes you say, hey, what are you doing? Get out of there. For most people, the way you demonstrate Torah is not by rebuke, but it's by positive acts of friendship and togetherness. Okay, so remember this translation. When it said, actually, let's see what the article translates, because I'm interested in that.
Admonition,
okay. This is in Parshas Kedoshim. This is in Vayikra, page, should be 658. I'm sorry, 660. Yeah, Perek Yates, Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17. Yeah, the English is on 661. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. That's the Ramban's idea of not keeping in your heart. You shall reprove your fellow. Right, so they translate it reprove. I'm not sure. Well, reprove is like admonish. But the real answer is, the real translation is, you shall demonstrate. And admonishment is one form of demonstration. But very often it is not the only form, and very often it is not the best form. And that is how you gauge the concept of tochacha. Now let me give you an example of this, where Shlomo Zalman Orbach is a very interesting psak. According to the law of the Shulchan Aruch, I guess this is a bit of digression, but I think it's worthwhile to talk about it for a minute. According to the law of the Shulchan Aruch, I'm not allowed to give food to somebody who's not going to make a bracha. Because I don't give food to a person unless they wear a yarmulke when they eat and make a bracha. So, to a Jewish person. In fact, I read that the Gera Rebbe brought over food to a non-religious Jew who was putting in an air conditioning system, and he brought over food with a yarmulke. So the Chiloni said, this little kfayet, what's the yarmulke for? So the Gera Rebbe says, well, I'm bringing you some food and you can make a bracha. So he says, well, the food is fine, but I don't make a bracha. So the Gera Rebbe took away the food and he says, well, no bracha, no food. No. So the Gera Rebbe followed the halacha specifically that way. But Shlomo Zalman Orbach paskened that Bizman Hazeh, if you have a visitor in your home, you're pretty sure they wouldn't want to make a bracha, you are still permitted to offer them food. And his reasoning was the following. His reasoning was, because by not offering them food, you'll create a desecration of God's name, you'll give the impression that religious Jews are not hospitable, and that may cause them to do more averos than they would. In other words, the concept is, if I offer them food, they don't make a bracha, they're doing one avera. But from that one avera, they'll get an appreciation of a religious Jew, and ultimately that may help them in tshuva. As opposed to not giving them the food, you may have served an avera, but you have taken away the opportunity of creating tshuva. And that's relevant to a lot of things. That's relevant to the issue of many kiruv organizations have this problem. You want to make a Shabbos event, and for non-religious people, college event or something. And many of them will not be willing to stay in a neighborhood within walking distance for 24 hours. So they're willing to come in Friday night, but they're going to drive home afterwards. So the question is, do you take the position, we don't have that event because we're going to cause them to drive? Or do you take the position, we'll do it, we'll offer them the hospitality, but if they decide to drive in and out, all right, so there are different psukim, but again, Shlomo Zalman Orbach did paskin that one is permitted and even encouraged to make events, even if some people will drive to them and from them, because by exposing them to Shabbos, this could eventually bring them to tshuva. And if you don't have the event at all, you have a chance of being exposed. However, I would differentiate. You have to be very careful in applying this psukim. Because people apply this psak indiscriminately to bar mitzvahs and bas mitzvahs and you know, all sorts of things. And I'll make a bar mitzvah and I'll invite everyone who will drive. Shlomo Zalman was talking about a very specific program that was targeted with education and various other components. It wasn't just a social event, you know, which happens to have a Shabbos meal attached. So one has to be careful in applying that psak. Yeah.
You invite somebody, you're probably going to drive by saying that you know you're available and stay as long as you need to.
Right. You have to make accommodations available for them that are comfortable, not you know, under the kitchen sink or something. And you also should indicate that you have a strong preference and desire. But if they then decide not to pick you up on it, you do not have to withdraw the invitation.
It's better to invite them for Shabbos for Seder if they wouldn't keep it or right. Do anything.
That's correct. Right. That is correct. That's correct. On the other hand, if they have some alternative that they would be going to that would be kosher, you know, then better for you not to do that.
You're saying that if it's a bar mitzvah or a wedding, and you met, or not a wedding, but let's say a bar mitzvah
I would not apply this. I would not apply this, generally speaking, to bar mitzvah. I would apply this to an event where you will have some personal involvement with them, not just they're going to be there with hundreds of other people without any particular educational program, just to watch. You know, I would not necessarily think that's appropriate to be the cause of someone to do an aveira.
Either move it to different day or don't invite them, that kind of thing?
Or what a lot of people do is that they have a Shabbos thing for a small number of people, and then they make a bar mitzvah on Sunday. They make a party on Sunday or whatever it is. But you know, in the States, the mitzvahs are a much bigger deal than, what do they say? In America, we emphasize the bar and less of the mitzvah.
If you have a shul in, let's say, a small area,
right.
And like by you know that if you get them to come to people come to shul on Shabbos, you know they might drive, but in the long run they might become more observant.
It could be that you could. I mean, one needs to discuss it, but it would be shayach in many cases like that. If the rav is going to be involved in being the karev then, there would be such a head.
You had mentioned about the tocha applies to the big tocha in Devarim, right? That's the term?
That's also called the one of, yeah.
Because
yeah.
Here they do a translate as admonishment.
So they translate tocha as admonition. It's interesting, which is also not the way they translate it in Vayikra.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, but be it as it may, this is what we got on. This is the lesson of Bilam, not letting your emotions control your mind and your intellect, but letting your mind and your intellect control and direct your emotions, in particular as it applies to anger, etc. Here's the thing. It's very interesting, though, that we see in Parshas Pinchas exactly the opposite idea. And that is the following. If you remember, and again, I'm going over Parshas very quickly here, but if you remember, essentially, the prophecies of Bilam. Bilam tried to curse the Jewish people three times. And every single time he tried to curse the Jewish people, God changed it into a blessing. Well, Bilam did not keep his contract, and Balak is very annoyed because Balak paid Bilam a lot of money, and Bilam finally gets sent home in disgrace, not being able to do his job. But Bilam had a lot of determination, and Bilam basically told Balak at the end of the parsha, you know, maybe my cursing isn't working today, for whatever reason. My timing is a little off. Maybe I don't got the right minute. But I'll give you a good piece of advice that'll cause the Jewish people to be cursed, even not through me. And if you remember, the piece of advice that Bilam gave Balak was to entice the Jewish people to commit promiscuous sexual behaviors. Adultery with the daughters of Moab. Right? In other words, the northern Moab dressed up very beautifully with perfumes and with jewelry, and they enticed the Jewish people not only to commit intercourse with them, but also to worship Avodah Zarah. And the Avodah Zarah of Moab was called Baal Peor. Baal Peor is an interesting, if not repulsive, type of idolatrous worship. It was worshipped by defecation. That's how Baal Peor was worshipped, and the Jewish people got into that, etc. And indeed, Bilam was right on the mark, because a tremendous plague broke out among the Jewish people because of Baal Peor. And the plague kept on going, and 24,000 people died in the plague. And now this is the introduction to the Pinchas story. And among the two people, among the people who were committing a very serious aveira, was a man from the tribe of Shimon, whose name was Zimri ben Salu. And he was with a Midianite woman, because this was a combination of Moab and Midian, a Midianite woman whose name was Cosby Bas Tzur. They were having intercourse in a very public place, and Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron, took a sword, and took a spear, and he killed both of them right when they're physically together, and the Magefa stopped as a result of Pinchas' intervention. And that's how Parshas Balak ends. Parshas Balak ends with the intervention of Pinchas in the killing of Zimri and Cosby, and the Magepha stopped, and at the point the Magepha stopped, it had taken the lives of 24,000 people. Now, it's very interesting that Chazal explained the scene in a much more graphic way. Chazal basically say that Zimri and Cosby were having intercourse out in public, and Moshe Rabbeinu tried to stop them. And when Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Stop this," so they turned, the people of Shimon, the people of Zimri's tribe, turned to Moshe and said, "Hey Moshe, why are you so righteous? Who allowed you to marry the daughter of Yisro from Midian?" Because what are you complaining? Zimri is with a Midianite woman? You are married to a Midianite woman. Now, of course, that's a total non sequitur because Zipporah underwent a conversion. But the point is, Moshe Rabbeinu was left speechless. We'll see why. He didn't know what to say at such chutzpah, such effrontery, such arrogance, unbelievable arrogance. And then Pinchas goes to Moshe and says to Moshe, "Moshe Rabbeinu, didn't you teach us the halacha that if a Jew and a non-Jew are fornicating publicly..." This is a very unusual halacha. There's a similar law in Texas. If a man comes across his wife sleeping with another man, he may kill them in what's called a delicto, meaning if they're in the middle of the act. Once they have finished the act, he cannot do so. Well, there is a halacha as well, in flagrante delicto, meaning to say that if a Jew and a non-Jew are publicly meaning there are at least 10 people there, are publicly having intercourse, a zealous person, however that is defined, is allowed to kill them on the spot. Now, it's very important that you understand the limitations of this principle, that you don't come into somebody's apartment, they're intermarried, and shoot them. Number one, the intercourse must be done publicly. Number two, the ability to execute this sentence is only while they're having intercourse. As soon as they finish, so to speak, we have no authority. It's only a beis din that can punish it. We have no particular authority. But there is a halacha. So Pinchas asks Moshe Rabbeinu, we can kill them. They're publicly having relationship. And Moshe's answer to Pinchas was, he who reads the letter should be the one who delivers it. Meaning to say, you know this halacha? You go ahead and do it. So what's interesting here is that this is the source of the halacha, of what is called in the Gemara, Haboel Ba'aramis. Aramis means a Syrian woman, but it just means a non-Jewish woman. He who publicly has intercourse with an Aramis, with a non-Jewish woman, Kanoin Pogimbo, a zealot person, can kill him on the spot. But it's a very interesting halacha, because it says, if the person asks the shayla, am I allowed to do this or not, we tell him no. It's only if he doesn't ask. What's the concept? Because the concept is, if he has the presence of mind to ask the question, that means he's not, he's not the uncontrollable zealousness which acts out of enthusiasm and passion. Meaning, you're not a zealot if you ask. It's only if you don't ask that shows that you have the mantle of zealousness. Yeah.
What if it was the other way around?
Yeah, the halacha does not apply there on the grounds that the woman is considered to be more passive in the act, and therefore it's not a Jewish aveira that's being done with a maaser. Now, here is the thing. We then go on to the next parsha of Pinchas. Because again, people have to know that you have to read Pinchas as connected to the end of Parshas Bala. And God then says to Moshe the following. Because Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron the Kohen, removed my anger from the children of Israel, because he was zealous on my behalf, and therefore I did not destroy the Jewish people in my zealousness, therefore say to him, I will give unto him a covenant of peace. Now, and then it says, and to him and his children afterwards there will be eternal priesthood, because he was zealous on behalf of his God, and he brought atonement on the children of Israel. And then the Chumash says, and the name of the Jewish man was Zimri ben Salu, the head of the tribe of Shimon, and the name of the Midianite woman was Cozbi bas Sur, and her father was one of the kings of Midian. Midian had five kings. Now, Rashi raises the following question. Rashi raises the question, why does it say Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron? We usually don't give grandparents. What does it say? Pinchas, the son of Elazar. Why does it say Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron? So Rashi says the following explanation. Because after Pinchas killed Zimri, he was under a lot of criticism by the rest of the children of Israel. Because after all, just like Moshe married a daughter of Yisrael, Elazar is Moshe's nephew, Elazar is Aaron's son. Elazar also married a daughter of Yisrael. So Pinchas' mother was a Midianite woman as well. And Pinchas' own mother was a Midianite woman. She was the daughter of Yisrael. So the Shvatim said about Pinchas, who does this Pinchas think he is, that he goes around killing the head of the tribe of Shimon? This guy's grandfather, the mother of his father, fattened cows for idolatrous worship. Yisrael used to be an idol worshiper. So what gives him the right to punish the head of the tribe of Shimon? So that's why the Torah says, well, he's not only Pinchas, the son of Elazar, which comes from Yisrael, but he also is the grandson of Aaron. That kind of gives him good yichus. But l'chaira, the question you'll ask is this. Just because he has good yichus doesn't take away the bad yichus. Meaning to say, if their argument is that from his mother's side he comes from Yisrael, you don't really address that by saying that from his father's side he comes from Aaron. It doesn't really answer the issue. But here is how we would explain this. The Ksav Sefer says, this is the meaning of Rashi's interpretation. That Pinchas kills a man who was fornicating with a Midianite woman. The Shvatim are claiming Pinchas' intention was not for the sake of heaven. Pinchas was doing it because Pinchas, as it were, wanted to become a true believer by repudiating his own ancestor and thereby gaining admission into the inner circle of leadership. In other words, the concept might be, in fact, even say with Hitler, for example, there are recurrent rumors, some of which, you know, there's some evidence to it, that Hitler, and you know, it's awful to think of this, Hitler did have some Jewish blood in him. And sometimes you find that the person who may become the most virulent anti-Semite is because he has to show, you know, he has to repudiate those credentials. In fact, this was true. This was definitely true in New York. I remember this in the 1960s. The head of the Ku Klux Klan, who is not just anti-black, but also very, very anti-Jewish, the New York Times uncovered that he had had a bar mitzvah when he was 13 in some shul in Queens. And I think he committed suicide afterwards when that news came out, because he was devoting his whole life, you know, to talking about how Jews are inferior and everything else. So the Shvatim were arguing, you know why Pinchas killed Zimri? Pinchas killed Zimri because he himself comes from a Midianite woman. He himself can have aspersions that are cast on his legitimacy. So to show that he is firmer than thou, he is holier than thou, he is the one that takes the mantle of zealousness and exacts vengeance on those who live with the Midianite woman. But he's not doing it for the sake of God. He's doing it for the sake of his own reputation and standing in the community. Meaning, he is using zealousness as an excuse to improve his standing in the religious community. So the Ksav Sefer says, that's why the Torah emphasizes, he was Pinchas, how do you translate this phrase? Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron. The simple translation is, Pinchas, who is the son of Elazar, and Elazar is the son of Aaron. The Ksav Sefer says we can translate it differently. Pinchas was the son of Elazar, directly, and Pinchas was the son of Aaron spiritually. In other words, Ben Elazar or Ben Aaron, both was going back on Pinchas. What does that mean? What was the spiritual legacy of Aaron? Aaron is described in Pirkei Avos as Ohev Shalom, a lover of peace, a pursuer of peace. Meaning the Torah is testifying. Pinchas did not act out of anger. Pinchas did not act out of resentment. Pinchas did not act out of self-aggrandizements. Pinchas acted as a disciple of Aaron, a spiritual son of Aaron. Pinchas acted not because he hated Zimri, but Pinchas acted because he loved the Jewish people and he wanted to save them and he was motivated out of a love of Israel. And here we see a very, very important idea. Pinchas acted violently not because it was his nature. Pinchas acted violently precisely because it was against his nature, but it needed to be done for the benefit of Klal Yisrael. In fact, I once heard a wonderful line from Rabbi Avi Weiss. I don't know if you've heard of Rabbi Avi Weiss. He's a kind of a controversial rabbi in the United States. He's a very big social activist. You know, he'll go to Auschwitz. You know, when there was some question about removing the crucifixes from Auschwitz, etc. So he'll go there with Talos and Tefillin and get arrested. You know, he gets arrested a lot in different all over the world. He demonstrates for the Ethiopian Jews and the Syrian Jews. You know, whenever there's an issue. Very, very big activist. And, you know, some people like him, some people don't. But he once said, in order to be an effective activist, you have to hate it. You have to hate having your name in the paper. You have to hate making publicity, because that keeps you focused on the goal. You see, the goal is to help Jews. The goal is to eradicate injustice. But there becomes a certain point in which you become so infatuated with the publicity, with the press, with the conferences, with the banquets, that you start making decisions based on what will build up your name instead of what's best. So he says, a true activist hates it. Meaning, you'd rather not have your picture in the paper. You'd rather not. But you do it anyway because you're doing it for Hashem and for Klal Yisrael. Well, that's what the Torah is saying here. Pinchas did not use this occasion to express his aggression, his violence, etc., and find some targets. Pinchas' nature was Aaron's nature, loving, tolerant, forgiving. And he became a kanoi not because he was just looking for some way to displace his energy. He became a kanoi as an act of love for Klal Yisrael. And that's a very, very important idea, that true zealousness, again, whether it means you're throwing a rock at a car that's driving on Shabbos, does not come from hate, cannot come from hate. It must come from love. Sometimes that love may require that one takes a strong stance in rejecting things. But it must come from a love of Israel and not from a hate. And that's a very important lesson. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik used to say, how do you difference between a true kanoi who truly loves Hashem and loves the Jewish people and a kanoi that looks to find the faults in others so they could expose their shortcomings? So Rav Chaim says it's analogous to a housewife and a cat. Let's say a housewife has a house that's infested with rats. So she buys a cat. The cat and the housewife share a common agenda to a certain degree. Both the cat and the housewife hope that if there are mice, the cat will get them. But the difference is, the housewife would be much happier if there are no mice at all. And the cat would be very, very disappointed. The cat hopes there'll be plenty of mice that it can pounce upon and rip apart. A true kanoi, like Pinchas, gets no joy in identifying and seizing on the shortcomings of other people. It's a source of great pain because they love their Jewish people. They love Hashem and they love Klal Yisrael. And when they see a Jew that's not keeping a mitzvah, it's a source of pain and anguish to them. And not only do they want to protect the rest of Klal Yisrael from that, but they want to help that person as well. and their inclination would be to open their home to them, to talk to them, to be makar of them, to have education for them. And, but if it's necessary to protest, they protest. But there's no joy in exposing the failings of others. But there's a type of kanoi that we sometimes have in the world, where nothing gives them more pleasure but to find something treif in somebody else, and then magnify. And as it said, you know, we don't have the geula, but it's so much more fun to say that we don't have Mashiach because of something somebody else is doing. It's always nice to point, yeah, if only he would do that, or she would do that, or they would do that, then we would have geula. When in reality, it's our responsibility to always look into ourselves. That the Ksav Sefer says is why the Torah emphasizes Pinchas was a Ben Aaron in that act. Ohev Shalom for Redev Shalom. Pinchas did not act out of hate. Pinchas did not act out of anger. Pinchas did not act out of resentment. Even for a Russia. Even for the Russia. He acted out of a love for the Jewish people. That was the motivation of his act. And therefore, if one is a kanoi without that sense of love, one is a murderer. The difference between the virtuous act of Pinchas and plain vigilante murder, which only God really could tell, is the difference in motivation. That for Pinchas, this was an act of the sanctification of God's name. And for other people, it might well have been just an act of murder. And in this sense, it's reminiscent of the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos that says that in Shemayim, if there are 999 angels that see bad in a person, and only one angel out of 1,000 says something good about the person, Hashem says that's enough for redemption. And then the Gemara goes on and says, if the one angel out of 1,000, 999 parts of that angel don't like the guy, and it's 1,000th out of one angel out of 1,000, Hashem says, that's enough for me too. And yet, we often live in a world where a person might have 999 good points and 1/1,000 of a bad point. And the signs will be up and the recriminations will...